down on a stool near the middle of the table.
Thank you.
The captain took a seat at the head of the table.
Now, what in the blazes do you need to be transporting a living bloody basilisk for?
Basil has no eyes. He needs me to look after him, and I need to accompany my friend on a mission she has overseas.
Oh, a lady friend? And here I had you pegged as a knobgoblin sperm tank.
I am a homosexual.
Captain Longfellow's face wrinkled up like an old man's scrotum.
And what in the seven hells does that mean?
Randy supposed that term might not have been coined here. Rather than stretch out this part of the conversation any more than he had to, he opted to use the term the captain was obviously familiar with.
I'm a knobgoblin sperm tank.
Yay! You'll find yourself in good company here.
Captain Longfellow flattened out the rolled-up sides of a map, spreading it wide across the table.
Now, what be your intended final destination?
We're trying to get to a place called Nazir.
The captain's eyes widened.
Oh, is that all?
He looked up at Alexei.
Do you hear that, lad? Just a quick trip to Nazir. Won't that be nice?
Randy frowned at the obvious sarcasm.
I take it there's a problem?
Too fucking right there's a problem, matey.
Well, if you're afraid, I suppose I'll have to take my business elsewhere.
Randy stood up. The captain leaned back and showed off his collection of gold and silver teeth.
That's a good try, son. Challenge my courage to my face in front of me first, mate. I've stabbed men for less.
Randy glanced back. Alexei was standing conspicuously in front of the doorway, arms crossed with a stoic look on his face. Randy suddenly felt bad for what he'd said and hoped Alexei wouldn't suffer any repercussions for Randy's rude behavior.
I apologize, sir. I meant no offense.
Captain Longfellow stood up and gave Randy a cold, hard glare.
Would you call a man craven for refusing to put his meat harpoon in a dire shark's mouth if his friends dared him to do it?
Randy shook his head.
I would not.
And would you call a man brave who would do such a thing?
Not brave, said Randy. More like insane.
More like craven. There's not to be gained by feeding your cock to a fish, but the fleeting respect of those who would see ye feed your cock to a fish. So one's only motivation for doing so would be fear. Fear of what those arseholes think of you, the rumors they'll spread about you. A fear so great, you'd rather sacrifice your own willy than face it. Can ye conjure in your mind a finer example of cowardice than that?
Randy looked at the floor.
No, I'm sorry, I...
Bend over, and I'll show ye where ye can stuff your sorries.
The captain sat down, leaned back, and put his worn leather-booted feet up on the table.
But, I'll admit to being intrigued as to what business a so-called paladin of the new god has with the Ice Queen of the Frozen Damned.
Randy pursed his lips, wondering how deep of shit they were getting themselves into.
That's actually the first time I've heard her referred to as such. But like I said, it's my friend who has business with her. Her brother died, and then Basil, my basilisk, ate him. We brought a pile of Basil's excrement to the Temple of Life. The cleric there told us the only way to bring my friend's brother back to life would be to retrieve the missing eye of Rasha, which the Ice Queen apparently has mounted on her scepter.
And you think that you and your merry band of cum-gargling scallywags is going to march right up to the Ice Queen, kick her in the box, and swipe her scepter?
That's actually more of a plan than what we've come up with so far.
You're all mad.
Captain Longfellow flipped a gold coin with his thumb and caught it in his palm.
I appreciate a touch of madness. Keeps things interesting. I'll take ye as near as the Callista Island chain, but no nearer than that. Perhaps there ye can find someone daft or desperate enough to take ye the rest of the way.
Randy grinned, his heart refilled with hope.
Thank you, Captain. So that's three passengers, you say, plus the basilisk, of course.
And a wolf.
A wolf?
Sorry, said Randy. It's my friend's animal companion. He's generally pretty quiet, so much so that I forgot all about him until just now.
Well, this is your last chance to jog your memory, lad. Don't be showing up on the dock with six kangaroos and a herd of bloody elephants ye forgot to mention.
Randy nodded.
That's all. I'm sure of it.
I'll trust you to keep the wolf contained in your carters. That won't rattle the crew or the other passengers up too much anyway. But the basilisk, that, we'll have to keep hidden. We'll set sail in 2 days' time.
He walked along the table until he came to a pile of long scroll tubes. He removed the paper from one and unrolled it on the table, displaying an older map of Cardinia from a time when it was a little less crowded and developed.
There's an old storm drain at the bottom of the city wall here,
the captain continued, pointing at a spot on the southern wall near the coast.
The bars are loose. You should be able to remove enough of them to squeeze that big bastard through. Once you're in the tunnels, you'll follow this one all the way up here where you'll turn right.
There were no tunnels drawn on the map, but the captain traced his grimy finger along a main avenue and stopped at what appeared to be an only slightly smaller street. It looked like it would be obvious enough to find.
Two of me most trusted men will meet ye here and escort ye to the maiden's voyage. It'll cost ye 200 gold pieces. Make sure ye bring it with ye then. New god or no new god, I'll not be loading a basilisk on me ship on faith alone.
Chapter 15. Dave, Captain Righteous, and Bingham attracted stares in each place they entered. They looked neither fun-loving nor wizardly, and the stares were making Dave feel even less so on both fronts. He took a drink from a passing tray, then caught Captain Righteous glowering at him like he was boiling his own mother.
What? I thought you might take this assignment a little more seriously.
You need to loosen up, man, said Dave.
Have you not noticed that we're being gawked at everywhere we go? Mordred will see us coming a mile away.
Captain Righteous frowned at all the people having fun around him.
We do seem to stand out. Very well. One drink each.
He took two drinks from a tray and glared at Bingham as he passed one to him.
Small sips.
Yes, uncle,
said Bingham, timidly accepting his pink drink. Whatever family issues Bingham and Righteous had were their business. Dave wouldn't be told how much of his slightly alcoholic Gatorade he was allowed to drink. He was a dwarf, and this stuff would have zero effect on him. As much as they stood out, they at least had the advantage, or so Dave hoped, of Mordred not knowing that they had escaped from their cages. Mordred, on the other hand, would be at a disadvantage. He was a halfling, which would make it easier for him to hide in most circumstances, but in the current circumstances, he wouldn't know there was anyone he should be hiding from. Plus, halflings were few and far between here, which made those few stand out more, especially if one was looking for them.
"Excuse me," said Captain Righteous, gripping a purple-robed man with severe black eyebrows by the shoulder. "We're looking for a red-robed halfling."
"I've seen nothing of the sort,"
said the man, annoyed at having been grabbed by the shoulder. But once he gave Captain Righteous a good look up and down, his expression mellowed.
"But there are live nude gnomes across the street. I can take you there if you like."
"That will not be necessary."
Captain Righteous released the man and took more than a little sip from his drink.
"Such decadence and debauchery will be the ruin of our society."
Dave considered saying something about not being so uptight, but he chose instead to just ignore the captain and drink. Scanning the room for another floating drink tray, something caught his gaze and held it. An old man sitting alone at one of the black granite tables outside on the patio. Black and white forked beard. Why does that seem somehow...
Murkwort.
Dave grabbed Captain Righteous's arm.
Unhand me at once, dwarf!
Dave glared at him, but let go.
Stop calling attention to yourself, and look at what I've found!
He turned around.
What are we looking at? Asked the captain. The sad old man with the black and white beard?
Yes. Is that Mordred? No, but he's the last person known to have been in possession of the magic dice. Catherine's friend lifted them off Frank and must have sold them to Murkwort.
Captain Righteous raised his eyebrows.
Catherine's friend?
Murkwort said he was coming here to make some big score.
Why is he alone? Has the transaction perhaps not yet taken place?
Dave shrugged.
Who knows? He could be waiting for Mordred to show up right now.
He looked around nervously, but didn't spot anyone who jumped out as obviously Mordred. Captain Righteous stroked his mustache.
Would this Murkwort recognize you?
I doubt it. I've only met him once, very briefly,
and he seems really self-absorbed.
We should move in closer,
said the captain, gulping back the rest of his drink.
If this Mordred person and these dice are as powerful as you seem to believe, we should seize this opportunity to keep them apart.
He frowned at Bingham, who was holding a pink drink in each hand.
I saw you were almost finished, so I got you another one.
Bingham handed a skeptical-looking Captain Righteous one of his drinks. Dave swigged back the rest of his drink, then swapped an empty glass for a full one. Together, they passed under the large stucco archway to the patio to keep a closer eye on Murkwort and discuss their next course of action. It was less crowded outside, with most of the wizards preferring to be closer to the music. Dave was relieved to be in more open air with less noise, and he suspected Captain Righteous felt the same way. Bingham gazed longingly back inside at all the rich and successful young people leading interesting lives full of women, magic, and free booze. This was as close to being a part of that world as he would ever get. At least that's how Dave interpreted his expression. Bingham might have been diligently looking for a halfling in red robes or another floating drink tray, but Dave got a strong vibe of hopeless inadequacy in Bingham's piggy eyes. It was the same vibe he'd picked up from Murkwort at Arby's. Murkwort had been so eager to impress Goosewaddle, so thirsty for just a taste of genuine respect. But this place, the Crescent Shadow, wasn't like strolling in on your old college roommate while he's struggling to run a shitty fast-food restaurant and showing off some new magical knick-knacks you recently picked up. The people here had truly made something of themselves. He'd tried to use just the fact that he was going here to impress Goosewaddle. He might be able to sell some dice here, but he wasn't going to impress anyone. That was their inn.
We need to go talk to him, said Dave.
Captain Righteous nodded.
Very well, I thought it might come to that. What information are we trying to extract from him?
Nothing specific. Whatever he wants to tell us. But remember, everything he says is amazing.
Captain Righteous frowned as he eyed the eccentric wizard.
Perhaps you are easily impressed. I have my doubts. Look at his beard. Someone who is genuinely interesting needs not try so hard to call attention to themselves. It reeks of desperation.
Yes, said Dave. That's what I'm talking about. We need to feed that desperation. Keep him talking and drinking. You get where I'm going with this?
Bingham nodded enthusiastically and gulped down some of his drink.
Thoughtless as this plan seems, it is better than more inaction. Lead the way, dwarf.
Dave thought for a moment until he came up with an icebreaker, then headed to Murkwort's table.
Excuse me, sir.
Murkwort, lost in thought, jumped when Dave interrupted him. He furrowed his bushy black and white eyebrows at Dave, then peered up at Captain Righteous and Bingham.
What's the matter? Am I in some kind of trouble? Have I not as much a right to sit at this table as any other wizard here?
Ha ha, said Dave. Heck yeah, you do. I just... Hey, are you Murkwort the Magnificent?
He wasn't sure if the magnificent part was overplaying it, but he'd committed to the role, and it slipped out of his mouth.
Is that what people are... I mean, yes. Yes, I am.
The magnificent thing had paid off. Dave was fairly certain that no one had ever called him that, and the fact that he lapped it up so readily was evidence that either he believed it might be true or, more likely, he'd simply take what recognition he could get. Dave nudged Captain Righteous.
I told you it was him.
Yes, you were correct, said Captain Righteous. It was wrong of me to doubt you.
Dave turned back to Murkwort.
My brother saw you perform amazing feats of magic once. He described you to our village. I recognized you by your beard.
Murkwort stroked the forks in his beard with both hands.
The duality of light and shadow, sun and moon, life and death.
Whoa!
Dave nudged Captain Righteous again.
That's so profound.
Indeed, said the captain, not really selling it. Profound.
Dave patted around his armor.
I wish I had something for you to sign. Oh, won't the guys at the pub be impressed when I tell them I actually had a conversation with Murkwort the Magnificent?
Murkwort raised one eyebrow and gave Dave a slight grin and a sideways glance.
Might they be even more impressed if you told them you had a drink with Murkwort the Magnificent?
No way, said Dave. I couldn't possibly waste your time. I'm just grateful to have...
Nonsense! I insist you all sit at my table and have a drink.
lest rumor spread that Murkwart the Magnificent is anything but gracious and humble before his admirers."
He thrust a hand out dramatically, causing Bingham to jump and yelp. A serving tray, which had been collecting empty glasses on the other side of the patio, changed course and flew toward their table. Moving his fingers in a wave-like pattern, he turned his wrist down, then brought it back up. A shiny platinum coin had appeared in his hand. Bingham clapped excitedly. Dave had to hand it to him. He was really selling the fake enthusiasm. Dave and Captain Righteous joined in the clapping, but neither could bring themselves to match Bingham's effort.
"Special drinks for my special guests," said Murkwart as he placed the coin on the tray, which zoomed back inside.
Over the next couple of hours, Dave, Captain Righteous, and Bingham listened to Murkwart talk about himself, his opinions on magic, his personal contributions to the Great Library of Cardinia, and how young wizards might as well practice sorcery for all the effort they put into the craft. His ability to talk constantly for such a length of time seemed magical to Dave. He only paused once to shake his head at one of the big lights flying above them as it sailed off the edge of the island, then used that as an example of how young people are ruining everything. Bingham sucked back drinks as fast as he could, hanging on Murkwart's every word. Captain Righteous continued to nurse his first drink, drumming his fingers against the side of the black granite block he was sitting on. His boredom and impatience were beginning to show. Dave feared he might lose his patience altogether and say or do something to jeopardize the tiny and fleeting advantage they currently had, so he decided to say something less potentially damaging instead.
"Do you have any special magic items?"
It may have been the lamest question anyone had ever asked a wizard in the history of this imaginary world, but it was the best Dave could come up with.
"Do I ever?" said Murkwart.
He didn't seem at all put off by the lameness of Dave's question. He leaned in and whispered,
"Would you like to see some?"
Bingham grinned and nodded. Captain Righteous snapped out of his bored annoyance.
"I would be most intrigued."
Murkwart stood and offered his right hand to Captain Righteous and his left hand to Bingham.
"Join hands, my friends, and I shall show you wonders the likes of which you've never seen."
Okay,
said Dave, as he, Bingham, and Captain Righteous hesitantly held hands with each other and Murkwart.
"Are we, like, saying a prayer first?"
Murkwart grinned down at him.
"Home."
The next thing he knew, Dave was in total darkness. He, Captain Righteous, and Bingham, still holding hands, fell on their asses. The granite chairs had disappeared from under them. They were in a circular room with wooden floors and stone walls lined with shelves filled with leather-bound tomes. The four windows were open, but it was as dark outside as it was inside. They must have either traveled through time, or more likely, time zones.
"Where are we?"
demanded Captain Righteous, hopping up to one knee and reaching out into the empty air in front of him. Bingham stayed on his back, but also groped at the air with his hands and feet. Dave remembered that he was the only one of them who could see in the dark.
"Lights!"
said Murkwart. Torches along the walls came alive with a whoosh of flame, illuminating the room.
"Welcome to my home."
Dave went to one of the windows and looked outside. They were in something like a tower. Not a tower exactly, as Dave could see the roof just above him, and they were only about 30 feet off the ground. More like a 3-story, cylindrical house designed to look like a tower. It was one of a group of neighboring tower houses in a city. A little ways away, the familiar uneven spires of the Cardinian Royal Palace twinkled against the black sky.
"Are we in Cardinia?"
he asked Murkwart.
"Indeed, we are."
Dave didn't have any great love for Cardinia, but he was overwhelmed with relief to be off that flying island.
"Have you been here before?"
asked Murkwart.
I...
Dave panicked, remembering that he was supposed to be some dwarven country bumpkin, awestruck by meeting a famous wizard.
"I'm from Hillstown."
"Oh my god, I've killed us all."
"Oh yes,"
said Murkwart, gliding toward Bingham, who was staring at something on a workbench. It looked like an old mummified hand attached to a chain.
"Look at this."
Dave relaxed, remembering that Murkwart truly didn't give a shit about anybody but Murkwart. Thrusting his hand forward dramatically as he'd done with the drink tray, Murkwart telekinetically lifted the hand off the workbench. He pulled it through the air to his open palm, then slipped the chain over his head, letting the corpse hand hang down from his neck.
This ancient mystical artifact, all that remains of a once powerful elven wizard, grants me the power to move physical objects using only my mind.
To demonstrate, he pointed at a book on a desk across the room. The front cover opened, and the pages began to turn. Dave was pretty sure that was a zero-level wizard spell, but he pretended to be impressed and clapped with what he hoped was an appropriate level of enthusiasm. Captain Righteous followed his lead, but less convincingly. Bingham frowned thoughtfully.
"Isn't that the same spell you used to bring the hand to you?"
Murkwart's big grin at Dave and Captain Righteous's applause faltered.
"Well, yes, but to move the book pages, I use the hand rather than a spell."
"But if you know how to do the spell, then wouldn't it be easier just to do that? Plus, you wouldn't have to wear a dead elf's hand around your neck."
Murkwart narrowed his eyes at Bingham.
"It's not only meant for wizards. Anyone could use this."
Bingham's eyes lit up.
"Ooh, can I try?"
"No."
Murkwart's tone was curt, and now he was pouting. He'd been insulted in his own home by someone who was meant to be worshipping him. Dave thought fast. He needed to get Murkwart back to thinking about Murkwart.
"I thought it was amazing. In fact, I'd say that would be pretty hard to top."
"You'd say wrong."
Murkwart pointed at the desk across the room, and a drawer opened. Dave hoped that there was more to his performance. It would be difficult to fake excitement over yet another mage hand spell. Then out of the drawer rose an object that Dave didn't need to fake excitement over at all. A small leather pouch, about the perfect size to hold marbles, a bottle of Crown Royal whiskey, or some magical dice, meandered through the air to Murkwart's waiting hand. Murkwart held it up.
"What you see before you appears to be an ordinary leather pouch, does it not?"
"Yes," said Dave. "What's in it?"
"The contents of the pouch are not so impressive as the pouch itself."
Dave frowned.
"Really?"
"A little device of my own inventing," said Murkwart,
dipping two fingers into the mouth of the bag.
"Allow me to demonstrate. Does anyone feel a sniffle coming on? Perhaps you could use a handkerchief."
Pinched between his fingertips was a corner of black fabric, which he teased out until there was a full-sized black handkerchief tied off at the opposite corner with, drumroll please, a white handkerchief. Captain Righteous looked like Dave felt, embarrassed to be in the room.
"Wow,"
said Dave, as Murkwart continued to pull out his continuous chain of black and white handkerchiefs, his arm pulling more aggressively each time, and his face with a more exaggerated look of mock surprise.
"I've never seen anything like that
since the second grade." Murkwart was one of those guys who didn't know when to quit. The handkerchiefs were piling up into a mound at his feet, and yet he kept pulling them out. Dave thought that even if this had been his first time witnessing true magic, he would have grown bored with it already.
"How can such a tiny pouch contain so much within it?"
said Murkwart, in case anyone was unclear as to what was supposed to be so amazing. Captain Righteous knelt next to Dave and pretended to wipe something from his boot.
"If I knock him out," he murmured, "we could tie him with the handkerchiefs and give him a proper interrogation about the dice."
Dave was afraid he'd been thinking along those lines.
"Put a pin in that," Dave whispered back. "Let me try one more thing."
He waited for the captain to stand up again so as to not look like he was acting right after whispering conspiratorially. Just as he was about to speak, Bingham beat him to it.
"Are you saying you invented the bag of holding?"
"No, no, no."
"It's not a bag of holding," snapped Murkwart.
He stopped pulling out handkerchiefs.
"There's a much larger. This is a pouch of holding."
"I had a pouch like that once,"
Dave blurted out, a desperate attempt to stamp out the fire before it got out of control.
"Did you?"
Murkwart crossed his arms and sneered at Dave.
"The fat little dwarf, who was so impressed by some rudimentary first-year wizard school spells, claims to have a pouch of holding back home in Healerstown?"
"Hey," said Dave.
It wasn't his fault that Murkwart was a shitty performer. There wasn't any need to bring his weight into it.
"That's not what I meant. My pouch is ordinary. It's just something I keep my dice in."
"Dice?"
Murkwart's voice sounded suspicious. that hadn't transitioned nearly as smoothly as Dave had hoped it would.
Yeah, my friends and I get together and play our dice games on the weekend. I don't want to lose them, so I've got a little pouch to put them in. Looks just like that.
The way Murkwort was looking at him, Dave felt like he was wearing a sign that said, "I'm feeding you bullshit because I don't respect your intelligence." He really wished Julian was here to do this.
How nice.
Murkwort went to a tailor's dummy standing between two shelving units. It was wearing a blue cloak with a peacock feather or eyeball pattern around the torso, and what looked like an aviator hat on the iron orb which served as the head.
"I have one more invention which I'd like to show you. Would you like to see it?"
"Absolutely,"
said Dave, nearly absolutely sure that he didn't want to see it. Murkwort removed the hat from the dummy, then turned around to face them, once again wearing his performer's face.
"For my next demonstration, I'll need a volunteer."
Bingham's hand shot up.
"Me! Me!"
Murkwort scanned the room as if it was an auditorium full of people.
"How about..."
He pointed at Dave.
"You!"
"Fuck."
"I call this a helm of honesty," said Murkwort,
dramatically advancing toward Dave with the hat held out in front of him.
"It compels the wearer to speak the truth."
"Is that like a zone of truth spell?"
asked Bingham.
"Because we've..."
"Yes,"
cried Murkwort.
"But it's in a hat. Have you seen it in a hat before?" "No, you haven't."
He scowled at Dave.
"Please remove your helmet."
Dave looked to Captain Righteous for guidance, but couldn't read anything from his expression. He took off his helmet. Murkwort shoved the helm of honesty down on Dave's head. It fit very snugly.
"Now, what shall we ask him?"
"Oh, I know,"
said Bingham.
"Ask him if he's ever worn women's clothing before."
"Yes,"
said Dave, horrified that the word slipped out of his mouth involuntarily.
"I was at camp. It was a game we were playing. I don't..."
"Let's try something simpler," said Murkwort.
"Where are you from?"
"Gulfport, Mississippi,"
Murkwort frowned.
"I've never heard of such a place. Why did you make up such a terrible lie as Hillstown?"
"I didn't have much time to think. It sounded, I don't know, dwarfier."
"Why did you attempt to deceive me? What is it you truly want?"
"The dice,"
said Dave, unable to control himself.
"We need to get back home."
"I knew it,"
Murkwort cried, disgusted and betrayed.
"How dare you fill me with liquor and try to take advantage of me like a common harlot? Do you not know why they call me Murkwort the Magnificent?"
Dave pressed his lips together, but the words forced themselves out.
"Nobody calls you that. I made it up to massage your fragile ego."
"Why, you impertinent little..."
Murkwort caught Captain Righteous making his move and held him paralyzed with a wave of the hand. The captain's arm cocked back to punch Murkwort in the face.
"You shall rue the day you insulted Murkwort, the
His concentration had broken, releasing Captain Righteous's fist to continue along its previous trajectory. Dave looked down and saw Bingham biting Murkwort hard in the calf. Once the old wizard collapsed on top of him, Bingham let go. When Dave finally got to the end of the handkerchiefs, there were enough of them tied together to practically mummify Murkwort and a chair together.
20 handkerchiefs is a novelty. 50 is a gag. Anything beyond that is just tedious."
"Put the hat on his head," said Captain Righteous. "We shall learn what's become of these dice. Everyone is in such a tizzy over." Dave put the helm of truth on Murkwort's head.
"Should we try to wake him up or wait for him to wake up on his own?"
Captain Righteous poked Murkwort in the shoulder.
"Are you truly sleeping?"
Murkwort sighed and opened his eyes.
"No."
"Where are the dice?"
asked Dave.
"I sold them."
"Shit, all of them?"
"Yes."
"To who?"
"Whom?"
"What?"
Murkwort glared at Dave.
"To whom?"
"Fuck you,"
said Dave.
"Who the fuck did you sell the goddamn dice to?"
Murkwort shrugged as much as his handkerchief's bindings would allow.
"The transactions were anonymous. It's standard practice. Buyers don't want sellers knowing their identity, lest they have a change of heart and seek to retrieve what they've parted with."
"You honestly have no idea how to get in touch with these people?"
"That's the point of anonymity."
"But all these anonymous transactions went down on the Crescent Shadow?"
Yes.
Dave suddenly remembered something he should have already asked.
Were any of these people halflings?
No.
That was a relief, albeit not a strong one. Dave took a moment to gather his thoughts. What brought Mordred and Tim together, if not the dice? Something didn't add up. It was too much to think about right now, but Dave thought that there was still a chance, however slim, that Mordred didn't have the dice, and might not even know that they were floating around freely out there. Furthermore, those wizards who bought them off Mirkwort might all still be on the Crescent Shadow. If they left the island, they'd be exponentially more difficult to track down. Dave looked Mirkwort in the eye.
Can you take us back to the Crescent Shadow?
Yes.
Captain Righteous put a hand on Dave's shoulder, then addressed Mirkwort.
Are you willing to take us back to the Crescent Shadow?
Mirkwort sneered at him.
No.
That gave Dave a thought.
If we leave you here, are you going to break free from your bindings and kill us all?
Mirkwort's face contorted as he tried to lie.
Yes, God damn this cursed hat. And about how long would that take?
Heh, said Mirkwort.
You wouldn't even make it out to the tower. How would you do it?
Asked Dave.
I have a number of spells without somatic components with which I could free myself. Then I would simply incinerate you.
Dave frowned.
We don't want to have to hurt you. Is there any way we could guarantee our own safety from you without killing you or knocking you out?
My spells aren't all memorized,
Mirkwort reluctantly spat out.
You could set fire to my tower and burn all of my belongings.
Well, that settles it, said Captain Righteous. I'm not comfortable striking a bound prisoner, and certainly not murdering one.
Mirkwort gawked at the captain with terror in his eyes.
You can't mean...
Captain Righteous nodded.
We have no choice but to burn the place down.
Please,
cried Mirkwort.
Knock me out!
He craned his neck to give the captain a nice, easy target.
Come on,
said Dave.
If he prefers to be knocked out than have his home burnt down, then surely...
The knight's code is very clear, said Captain Righteous. I cannot strike a helpless prisoner. If we untie him first, then...
Dave shook his head.
No, that's definitely off the table. I'm sure that he's been planning in his head all along what he'd do if he could just free his arms for 1 second.
He looked at Mirkwort.
Right. Shit!
Mirkwort cursed at the floor.
Yes!
Dave had another sudden thought and tried to act on it, but Captain Righteous had clearly anticipated this and caught Dave's fist before it could make contact with Mirkwort's face, which was practically begging for it. He shrugged at Mirkwort.
Sorry, man. I tried.
No!
Cried Mirkwort.
All my books! All my research! There must be some other way!
Captain Righteous was already lighting a candle on Mirkwort's reading desk.
You'd better think of another way right fucking now if you want to save your home,
said Dave. Mirkwort bit his lower lip and groaned as Captain Righteous held a scroll over the candle flame.
Do you have anything?
Asked Dave.
Yes,
said Mirkwort.
Then why don't you say something?
Because I don't like it.
What is it?
Mirkwort writhed in his bindings, willing himself not to speak.
You could take me with you, and I can cast a contingency spell, which will trigger a fireball spell here in my office, should I attempt to deceive you.
Hmm, said Dave. That's pretty good.
He turned to Captain Righteous.
What do you think?
The captain nodded and blew out the candle flame.
I can live with that.
We should take him to the Horse Head. They can interrogate him until they're blue in the face, and we might be able to clear Tim's name, at least as far as the dice are concerned. I feel like I owe him that much.
Captain Righteous stroked his mustache.
Perhaps they will ask him a question with regard to the dice, which we didn't think to ask.
What's your stake in all this?
Dave asked Captain Righteous.
Why do you care so much about the dice?
Because I made a promise to Lady Catherine.
Chapter 16. Chaz had spent a nearly sleepless night making a list of pros and cons with regard to following Cooper into Glitter Sprinkles Grove. Getting the easy cons out of the way first, Cooper was an asshole and he smelled like shit. On the other hand, Chaz didn't know if there was anyone in this world, or the one they'd come from, whom he'd trust more to look out for him when the shit hit the fan. Sure, it was Cooper's fault that Chaz's chain snapped, mostly anyway. but no one would have given him too much grief about it. He obviously didn't mean to snap the chain, and no one would have faulted Cooper if he hadn't immediately leapt out of his own cage toward almost certain death to make a batshit insane attempt at saving him. That had taken balls of a magnitude that Chaz couldn't fathom. Surely, Cooper would show that same courage and disregard for his own safety to protect Chaz from whatever ghosts and ghouls were haunting Glitter Sprinkles Grove. Plus, he had a pretty badass magical axe. Then again, rather than count on the fearless support of someone who would give their own life to protect him, it might be safer to spend more time with people who weren't as likely to drag him into situations where both of their lives would be constantly threatened. Having thought that, Cooper was certainly not a person whom Chaz wanted to abandon right now, particularly after Cooper had so selflessly risked his own life to save Chaz's, even if it was his fault that Chaz's life had been endangered in the first place. Chaz's thoughts were becoming cyclical, and he wasn't sure if he was any closer to a conclusion now than he'd been when he'd started thinking about it, but he was quite certain he was more sleep-deprived. There were people and monsters all over this world who could and would rip Chaz to pieces without a moment's hesitation. At least in Glitter Sprinkles Grove, he'd have someone looking out for him. Abandoning Cooper now, right after Cooper had saved his life and while he was on a quest of honor, would mark Chaz as a coward to anyone who ever learned of it. Also, if Chaz let Cooper face this challenge alone and the worst should happen, he would have to live with that for the rest of his life. He didn't think he could. It didn't seem... He'd think about it tomorrow. Chaz woke up to what sounded like an outboard motor and what smelled like burning sulfur. Coughing and opening his eyes, he felt the sting of Cooper's ass, which was hovering over him, trumpeting its morning song.
What the ever-loving fuck?
Cried Chaz.
Honestly, what's wrong with you? What would possess you to squat over another person while he's sleeping and let one rip in his face?
Cooper shrugged.
I had to fart. It was time to wake up. Two birds, one stone. You should consider yourself lucky. I was about 8% sure that was only going to be a fart, but my estimates on that are usually way off.
I'm supposed to feel lucky because you failed to shit in my face? That's not luck. That's the default setting. Billions of people go their whole lives neither shitting on other people's faces nor having their own faces shed on by others. When a normal person needs to fart or shit, it doesn't even occur to that person to squat over a sleeping person's face. It's like you're trying to...
That was it. Cooper was being even more of an asshole than usual to dissuade Chaz from tagging along. Who could blame him for ditching Cooper after he'd just taken the dump on his face? It was the perfect excuse. Cooper was trying to save Chaz's life. Well, fuck that. Cooper had too much moral leverage on him already.
I've decided to come with you.
Fuck,
said Cooper.
Why?
You need me. I'm not as useless as you think.
Chaz unsheathed his rapier and swiped at the air.
I can swing a sword, after all.
If you roll really well, that might tickle a ghost. You're not useless. You're worse than that. You're a... what's the word? Lithuanian?
Liability,
said Chaz.
I think so. Does that mean, like... an extra pain in my ass that I'll need to babysit during an already difficult quest?
Chaz sighed.
It's closer to that definition than Lithuanian.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Cooper offered Chaz a sad-eyed, sympathetic grin.
So, you know, fuck off.
Chaz had to admit Cooper was making a very good case for him to leave, but Chaz refused to be outsmarted by someone so stupid.
No,
said Chaz.
I'm the pain in your ass that's coming with you to Glitter Sprinkles Grove.
Cooper shrugged.
Suit yourself. I'm not carrying your dead ass all the way back to Cardinia, though.
He started walking through the tall, dew-soaked grass in the same direction they'd been traveling the night before.
Wait!
Said Chaz.
No!
Said Cooper. Chaz shielded his eyes from the harsh mid-morning sun and looked around their little clearing. He hadn't unpacked anything, so there wasn't anything to gather. He could have done with a morning piss, but he supposed that could wait. The new day's journey suddenly begun, he ran after Cooper.
Where's Ravenous?
He asked when he caught up.
How the fuck should I know? Off killing rats or fucking turkeys or whatever it is birds do.
This was going to be an even longer journey if Chaz allowed Cooper to keep talking down to him the whole time. He was determined to prove his value somehow, to put them more on even footing with regard to mutual respect. But first, he really had to pee. Figuring there wasn't much chance of losing a half-orc in a meadow in the time it took to take a leak, Chaz sheathed his rapier, started to unlace his pants, and turned around. A massive bird monster, as tall as he was, stood in front of him, staring at him with the cold, don't-fuck-with-me expression of an eagle. In fact, all of it looked like an eagle, except for its legs. Though covered with feathers and ending with giant face-shredding talons, they didn't look like bird legs. Proportion-wise to the rest of the creature, they looked more human than bird-like, and something was off about its wings as well. Chaz had never stood face-to-face with an eagle before, but he was pretty sure something was off about its wings. Leaning slightly sideways, Chaz saw the answer to his confusion. This was no bird, at least not the back half of it. Golden feathers gave way to golden fur about halfway down its great cat-like rear, including the you're-so-fucked hind legs of a lion. The beast screeched, and Chaz's morning pee issue resolved itself down both pant legs. "Keep it together, Chaz. If it wanted to kill you, it would have attacked already. It's just stupid and curious. Just a big fucking bird with a tiny bird brain. One surprise slice across the throat, and breakfast would be on old Chaz this morning." He grabbed the hilt of his rapier, but the beast grabbed his upper arm. It felt like a bear trap that was on fire.
"Yow!"
cried Chaz. Instead of killing him outright, which Chaz now appreciated that this thing could probably do with very little effort, it began flapping its wings.
"No!"
squealed Chaz, not relishing the idea of being suspended a mile in the air by one arm that felt likely on the verge of breaking.
"Just kill me, please!"
His arm rose as the beast began to lift off the ground.
"No, I don't wanna!"
The eagle head jerked sideways as the flat of Cooper's axe smashed into it. Chaz fell to the ground, relieved to still have two arms, even if the top of his right one was a shredded, bleeding mess.
"Back off!"
said Cooper, turning the axe in his hands.
"Don't make me use the blade!"
The creature screeched at him, but flapped up out of his reach.
"Go on! Find something else to eat!"
Cooper closed his eyes in concentration, then let out a long, slow-burning fart, filling the air around him like an aura of ass. The lion eagle creature gave one last screech as it flew higher, convinced that better food would likely be found elsewhere. Chaz sat up, unable to bring himself to look at Cooper. He sighed.
"Whew! Thank you for saving my... Ooh!"
A deluge of white, bitter-tasting goop landed on Chaz's head. Cooper laughed harder than Chaz had heard anyone laugh in quite a while. Chaz spat and wiped shit out of his eyes with his good hand. When he could see, he looked up at the creature as it flew away.
"Fuck you, you stupid! Whatever the fuck you are!"
"It's a griffin,"
said Cooper.
"And what the fuck did you expect it to do after you tried to attack it?"
"What was I supposed to do?"
Cooper shrugged.
"I don't know. Maybe not attack it?
I was supposed to just wait around for it to tear me apart?"
"It would have left you alone if you'd taken the time to talk to it."
"Excuse me?"
said Chaz, standing up.
"I didn't think it could speak English."
"It can't speak the common tongue, but it can understand it."
"How the hell do you know so much about griffins?"
"I don't know shit about griffins,"
said Cooper.
"Nabi told me."
"Your axe?"
"She said it's a gentle creature until it's provoked, but it has a nest full of chicks that need to be fed. They're not too smart, so when it comes to people, they sometimes get confused. You made the decision easy when you tried to attack it."
Cooper paused a moment, nodding to himself as he received further telepathic communication from his axe.
"She says you've probably doomed all future humans who wander into this territory as well."
He paused again, then grinned.
"Yeah, I think he knows that."
"Knows what?"
said Chaz.
"She says you piss yourself."
Chaz stomped past Cooper and his axe, rapier drawn, shirt soaked with blood and pants soaked with piss, ready to stab something. Hearing a sudden avian screech behind him, he dropped his sword, fell to the ground, and curled up in a ball of bard.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Ravenous. "I didn't mean to frighten you."
Chaz uncovered his eyes and found Ravenous sitting on a branch of the tree he'd walked past.
"Where the hell have you been? We were just attacked by a griffin, you know."
"Oh, dear. That sounds dreadful. Did you try talking to it? I hear they're very reasonable creatures."
"Oh, shut up,"
said Chaz.
"How much further is it to Glitter Sprinkles Grove?"
You've still got quite a walk ahead of you. I expect you'll arrive there before nightfall, though.
Chaz got to his feet and started walking again.
Why don't you make yourself useful and keep an eye out for dangerous monsters?
I can do that.
Ravenous flew off and began flying in a wide perimeter around Chaz and Cooper as they continued southwestward on foot. Every so often, he spotted some prey in the tall grass and swooped down like a dive bomber. He killed rats, rabbits, and the occasional squirrel or chipmunk. Since Ravenous was only interested in eating the eyes, Chaz started going after his kills and picking up the rabbit carcasses. As morning turned to afternoon, Chaz's arm stopped bleeding, and he was actually feeling pretty good, gripping 5 dead rabbits by the ears. He felt like a frontiersman living off the fat of the land. This is how his ancestors had lived, except without a talking bird doing most of the work. All this walking built up quite an appetite, and he couldn't wait to see what roasted wild rabbit tasted like. It was only when lunchtime came around that it occurred to Chaz that there was nothing around here even remotely flammable. As he grew hungrier and the rabbit corpses grew heavier in his hand, he thought more and more about tossing them away. The gaping, bloody eye sockets were beginning to attract flies. Also, he considered that at some point he might get hungry enough to try to eat one of them raw, and he didn't want to have them around if it came to that. Who knew what kind of worms or E. coli or whatever they might be infested with?
I'm hungry,
he moaned, not caring what kind of grief Cooper would give him for whining.
There'll be wood in the forest. We'll roast those rabbits.
By the time they finally spotted a significant density of trees on the horizon, there was barely enough light to see them. He was so hungry that he was more excited about finding firewood than he was apprehensive about running into ghosts. As they neared the trees, Chaz thought he could already smell smoke in the evening air, but there was no sign of a fire. Probably just the hunger fucking with his brain. Walking between the sparser, outermost trees, nothing struck him as being especially spooky about these woods.
I wouldn't go much further in there if I were you, said a high-pitched man's voice behind them.
Chaz and Cooper turned around. Some kind of man-goat hybrid was standing on its hooved and furry hind legs, sizing them up. He was mostly man from the waist up, except for the curved horns on his head. His beard struck Chaz as goat-like as well, but that might have just been his personal style choice. Chaz had never seen a goat dick, but he now assumed they must be huge. This guy's dick hung down nearly to his fucked-up backward goat knees.
What the fuck are you?
Said Cooper.
Satan?
I am a satyr. Do my legs not give it away?
I'm not interested in what your legs are giving away.
What brings you two fine gentlemen to this stretch of wilderness? Are you lost? Might I be of...
Cooper pulled off his axe and brandished it at the massive dicked goat man, or satyr, as he preferred to be called, who froze like a statue of a confused Satan.
Whoa!
Said Chaz.
What the fuck, man? Put the axe down!
Touch those pipes,
said Cooper, his eyes locked on the satyrs.
And you'll be playing them with your asshole.
What pipes?
Asked Chaz.
I don't know. It's just what Nabi told me to say.
She told you to tell him he'd be playing them with his asshole?
Cooper shook his head.
I improvised that part. She told me not to let him play his pipes.
I beg your pardon, said the satyr. Did you say Nabi?
Yes.
The Fae Queen of Glitter Sprinkles Grove?
Cooper pursed his lips.
Maybe.
After a brief pause, he nodded.
I mean, yes.
But she has been missing since the Dark Ones invaded our land.
Blame it on the Dark Ones, the perfect scapegoat.
The satyr drew a dagger.
What did you call me, half-breed?
What the fuck?
I am not a goat.
I didn't. That was... Hang on. You're gonna get all racially offended right after you blame all your neighborhood's problems on the darkies moving in.
The Dark Ones.
Whatever. And now you're gonna lecture me on nomenclature, wouldn't you?
Cooper stopped talking and squinted at his axe for a moment, then looked at the satyr.
Lower your dagger, Zanzi, for I have returned.
The satyr's eyes widened.
Nabi!
Cooper nodded. After resheathing his dagger, the satyr knelt before Cooper and took his left hand in both of his.
What have they done to you?
He kissed Cooper's hand. Cooper jerked his hand free and wiped it on his loincloth.
Dude, what the fuck? It's not me. It's the axe.
The satyr took the axe and kissed the shaft between the blades. It was more than a polite token of reverence. It was all slobbery with a lot of lips and tongue.
Said
Chaz.
Would she be comfortable with you doing that if she wasn't an axe?
Of course she would, said the satyr, and resumed molesting the axe with his face. Cooper yanked his axe away.
She says otherwise, and it's uncomfortable to watch. Now who the fuck are you?
The satyr got to his hooves.
My name is Zanzifer Wobble Stomper.
Fuck all that,
said Cooper.
Can we just call you Satan for short?
Chapter 17. Rather than struggle to break free from Julian's magical webbing, Stacy suggested they let it deteriorate on its own, lowering them to the ground slowly, and use that time to catch their breath and gather their thoughts.
We've got one die and no Mordreds, said Stacy, turning her head toward Julian as much as the web would allow.
He was upside down relative to her, and his serape's broad surface area had caught a lot more web than she had.
Where do we go from here?
Some place where I can wash my hands, said Julian. I can still feel dwarf dick in my right palm.
Stacy laughed, but she asked the question for more than something to pass the time with.
And after that?
I don't know. Should we bring it back to the horse head?
That's the obvious answer. But if Mordred's out there gathering power and armies or whatever he's doing, maybe this little hiccup was a blessing in disguise. Maybe everyone is safer the fewer people there are who know the location of the dice.
Is that really our decision to make?
Asked Julian.
Who else's would it be?
Shouldn't it be the collective decision of everyone who could potentially be affected by it?
You mean like a democracy? Julian shrugged.
Sure.
That's fine under most circumstances, said Stacy. But when the decision is about whether or not to withhold information from a group of people, inviting those people to be part of the decision-making process kind of undermines the whole point of making the decision in the first place, doesn't it?
Julian took a few moments to run that through his mind.
Not necessarily, he finally said.
Oh?
Well, let's say we take the die back to the horse head and give them a full report on what happened here. We tell them we have a die, but we propose just what you said, that it might be safer for everyone if the dice were hidden somewhere and only one or two people knew the location.
Stacy laughed.
What? Said Julian.
You've seen that group try to make a decision before, haven't you? They're a mess, and what's more, they don't trust each other. Do you honestly think they'd be able to come to any kind of agreement on who gets to know where the dice are hidden? There'll be a bunch of noisy arguing and bickering, and will only lead to them deciding that, since they can't decide who to trust with the dice, that the dice should stay there at the horse head, which I think you can understand is an extremely unwise decision.
It just seems, I don't know, unethical?
It's practical. You get a bunch of scared, not terribly bright people together, and they'll make decisions undermining their own best interests, knowing that they're doing so, if it means making sure that no individual or faction among them appears to benefit disproportionately. Look at the American South.
Julian frowned.
You make a good point there.
Sometimes people need to be protected from themselves.
I just don't know if I'm ready to take on that kind of responsibility.
The last few tendrils of web holding Stacy up stretched to the point of snapping and released her safely on the ground. She looked up at Julian, who, being lighter than her, was still about 15 feet up.
I don't know if we're going to have much choice. Do you have any idea how to get off this island?
Julian shook his head. Stacy tried to tuck the pendant between her boobs, but the silver dragon claw gripping the die was clunky and uncomfortable. Instead, she took off the whole chain and tucked it into one of her rogue outfit's many hidden interior pockets. From her bag, she pulled out the rope she'd used on her cage before they were rescued by that random gnome guy.
Catch!
She said, tossing up the coil of rope to Julian. When he caught it, she gave it a good yank, snapping the web string still holding him up.
Shit!
Cried Julian. Stacy dropped the rope and braced herself. The impact was less than she was prepared for. He really was a waif of a man.
It's been a long day, said Stacy, putting a still startled Julian down on his feet. We should get some sleep.
Julian looked around at the small grove of trees they were standing in.
Here?
Where else? I'm tired.
Do you think it's safe?
This island is pretty small. The uninhabited part of it is tiny. I don't think it can support a population of bears or lions or dinosaurs or whatever.
Julian found a cranny of tree roots to sit comfortably in.
Get some sleep, then. We'll figure out tomorrow when it comes.
Stacy laid down with her head in Julian's lap.
You mind?
Julian shook his head. Stacy took his hand and closed her eyes.
Are you thinking about Ravenous?
Yeah.
Of course he was. She could tell he'd been making an effort not to bring up his familiar, but he was never far from his mind.
Don't worry. I'm sure he's okay. We'll find him.
Julian gave her hand a squeeze.
Thanks.
In the meantime, think about what I said before. All I ask is that you don't tell anyone about the dice until we've made a decision between the two of us.
But if I agree to that, and we never make a decision between us, doesn't that amount to the same as if we agreed not to tell anyone?
Stacy smiled to herself. She'd been hoping Julian would be too tired to catch that.
Good night, Julian.
She let herself fall asleep. Chapter 18.
This must be the storm drain Captain Longfellow was talking about, said Catherine.
She, Butterbean, Randy, and Basil stood before a barred gate at the base of the southern city wall, not far from where it met the sea. The iron bars were coated with rust, and the stone holding them in place was worn smooth from centuries of water running over them, but it still didn't look like an accessible point of entry for anyone who hadn't thought to bring a bulldozer with them. Even if they were able to remove a couple of loose bars, it would be difficult to squeeze Basil through. Fortunately, Catherine had anticipated that the captain, having never seen a basilisk in person before, might have underestimated its size and had prepared a spell just for such a contingency. Having a limited number of spells per day, it seemed foolish to waste one to accommodate Randy's pet. The big lizard was also responsible for them having to waste all this time sneaking around storm drains in the middle of the night when they could have much more easily booked passage on a ship without it. But Catherine needed all the help she could get, and she didn't want to force Randy to choose between her and the lizard.
"I've been giving it some thought,"
said Denise from up on Basil's back. Catherine was ahead of her, holding the basilisk's right guide rope. With his head between her and Randy, she was pretty confident that nobody could see her rolling her eyes.
"Maybe I shouldn't go on this quest with you on account of I'm pregnant and all. I gotta do what's right by my unborn children, right?"
"The ones you want to abort?"
"I'm still undecided on that particular issue. It's a very personal decision, which will take much time, introspection, and alcohol to resolve."
"I'm sorry," said Randy. "Until you've decided what you want to do, and then gone and done it, I can't allow you to drink no more alcohol. It ain't fair to them babies."
"When the fuck did you become my goddamn keeper?"
"When you declared an intent to harm innocent people."
"They ain't even fucking people."
"We don't know how far along they are in their development," said Randy. "And the point at which a fertilized egg counts as a person is a matter of..."
"That ain't what I'm talking about," said Denise. "They ain't people. They're fucking scorpion monsters. It ain't your place to tell me I gotta carry these freaks to term."
"And I ain't saying you do. All I'm saying is that if you choose to have your pregnancy terminated, you do it proper-like. Get yourself checked out by a cleric and, I don't know, see how they do that sort of thing here. You had a chance to bring it up back at the temple."
"I was nervous," said Denise. "It was called the Temple of Life. How do you bring up killing babies in a place like that? I don't know how they feel about that sort of thing here. They might have crucified me or burnt me like a steak."
"At the stake," said Catherine.
Part of her was enjoying listening to Randy and Denise's redneck banter. She'd never considered herself to be a scholarly person, but being immersed in a conversation between these two made her feel like that guy in the wheelchair with the robot voice.
"Let me make this simple. I need all the help I can get, and that amounts to you two hillbilly retards."
She looked up at Denise.
"You tried to rape my brother, so you owe him this."
"Wah, wah, wah. You raped my brother. Don't that never get fucking old? I ain't raped shit. That little psycho cut my nuts off. Incidentally, that led to the game turning me into a tubby little bitch, which then led me to being raped and impregnated by a scorpion monster. So I think my rape debt has been paid with interest, thank you very much."
"Randy," said Catherine, "is that true?"
"It weren't rape exactly," said Randy. "As far as I could make out, it was consensual."
"Consensual?"
"That's right. In fact, she seemed really eager."
"I didn't consent to having fertilized eggs pumped into me. I thought she was a man. That was willful deception, which counts as rape.
I don't think she meant to deceive you, said Randy. She looked kind of hurt when you said you thought she was a man, and her husband looked pissed.
The conversation, while morbid,